Katha Pollitt is a wonderful author who has been contributing to The Nation since 1980. She's won many awards. She has several books out. And I particularly am happy to welcome her because her a recent collection has just been issued in paperback. It's called Learning to Drive and Other Life Stories. So, in fact, now are you on a new tour with the paperback book?
I think you're it.
Oh.
I'll be speaking and reading at some colleges this fall and being on any radio show that will have me.
Ooh, well, that's good to know. Maybe we have to have you frequently. Well,
yeah,
Let me say this. You know, the book, when it came out in 2007, Random House, generated a lot of interest and some, I guess, curiosity about, let's begin with the first essay is called Learning to Drive, and in this essay you reveal boldly enough that at the age of 52 you didn't know how to drive. Tell our listeners why that was.
Well, I should say just a little bit about the book as a whole so people will know sort of what we're discussing. Learning to Drive is a collection of personal essays, which is a real departure for me since I, you know, write a column in The Nation that's fairly political, and I'm also a poet, but I never written this kind of autobiographical essay before. And unlike my other my political column, it's not very overtly political. In fact, I don't think it is at all. It's more trying to get at some aspects of life today and my life, women's lives, but not in an ideological way, more just exploring it. And what that meant was that as I explored various facets of my life, for example, this fairly disastrous breakup in midlife, which led me to have to confront the fact that I was now going to have to drive myself, as opposed to having men drive me about, that's a very, I think, a very pregnant issue, but I don't talk about it in a kind of you should do this, you should do that kind of way. It's more exploring. What does it mean to have to grow up in certain ways in midlife?
And also, we live in a culture of normalcy and conformity. And for you to have exposed what many would have considered a flaw, I thought was very brave. You know, interestingly enough, there was an op-ed piece in the Times a while back that said that actually teenagers report that they don't even feel like they need to drive. Their parents are willing to take them where they want to go. And in the last decade, the proportion of 16-year-olds nationwide who hold driver's licenses has dropped from nearly half to less than one-third.
Well, and that's very interesting. But the funny thing is that I didn't see not having a driver's license as, you know, some big shameful thing. I grew up in New York,
and
we didn't have driver's ed in school. And you wouldn't want to have a car in New York. I don't understand why people do it. It's a major pain in the neck. They're always getting stolen. You have to park them, you know, from one side of the street to the other all the time. And if you, you know, it costs as much to garage your car in New York as it does to rent an apartment in most other places.
Yeah, exactly.
So I know a lot of people who grew up in New York around when I did, who just one thing led to another. They just didn't get their license. Or maybe they have their license, but they actually have never driven. I have several friends like that. I didn't see talking about this as some big deal. I thought the other stuff was more of a big deal. The idea that, you know, that you could live with someone as being a smart, savvy feminist who's supposed to be in control of everything, and yet you'd find that just like anybody else, a skillful philanderer can get around your defenses.
Actually, I think you hit on it exactly. I think the thing that is surprising about the book is, just like you said, being a competent feminist and an accomplished woman, people are very gratified, I think, and relieved to read that you have some struggles. And
you know, it's interesting you say that, Benny, because some people were relieved that I, like other mortals have struggles. And other people thought I had really committed a sort of a political faux pas in revealing this side of myself.
Because? Why?
Well, because they felt it was oversharing. They wanted me to be a feminist icon. They felt it made me look too vulnerable. And there was actually, this is what the discussion, there was a lot of discussion around the book. One person wrote in an online article, you know, have we come far enough so that, you know, we can reveal these, you know, vulnerabilities and weaknesses? No, we haven't, you know. And I'm just sort of thinking, oh, honestly, you know, you never get anywhere if you... I think we have come that far. And not only that, the whole idea of the personal is political, which is a very problematic statement in certain ways. But the idea, that's how you advance. You advance by acknowledging what your real difficulties in life are, not by pretending everything is great because, you know, you wear a power suit and you've got a job.
Yeah, and, you know, it's almost like as women, as feminists, we can't win. You know,
well, I think there is a little bit of that, and because another piece of it is that to admit vulnerability to men is a very risky thing. That I think, you know, for some feminists and some women, the official stance has to be, he's gone in good riddance. I didn't like him anyway, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm better off without him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I love being alone, all that. And, you know, I have to say, I'm sure there are people who love being alone, but I don't know them. most of the people I know are looking for some kind of connection with, you know, if they're heterosexual, a man, and if they're not heterosexual, a woman. And I think that to always have to pretend that nothing gets to you, I think that is a tremendous psychological pressure on people that does them no good.
I once remember being at a party, like a Yale-connected psychology department party, and there was a man there, very, very bright, who went around and said to people the following question, can you be cool and still be real?
And what did people say?
I think it was like what you're saying. I think they hesitated because
it felt
like...
Well, I guess if you're naturally cool, then you can be cool and real. But if you're posing as cool, then of course you can't be real.
Right.
So with Jack Kerouac, he was cool and real.
Mm-hmm. And you know,
he spent a lot of time in his mother's house.
This
I don't think
is
people
true.
Knew that at the time.
I'm not sure he drove. Didn't Neil Cassidy drive him around?
I think he did, yeah.
See that? Here we go.
Neil was the driver.
Did you, you know, given that this is a collection of essays, that it's very wide-ranging, I should explain to the listeners that it covers chapters about being in a Marxist study group, about raising a child, about your mother. I mean, it's very far-reaching. Was it your decision or you and the publisher to call it Learning to Drive, to make, you know, the first two essays originally appeared in the New Yorker, and that's where I read Web Stalker. And I should explain that Web Stalker is the second essay, connects with the first one, Learning to Drive, because it's about discovering this infidelity on the part of the man with whom you'd been sharing a life. And as you said just a minute ago, that's what led you to be forced to learn to drive, because there was a dependence on him in some way to get around?
Well, people are emotionally dependent on each other. And, you know, if you don't know how to drive, somebody else has to drive you.
Exactly. So even though you were in New York occasionally, maybe you wanted to...
No, I basically lived in New York, but I have a house in Connecticut.
You want to get out there.
In Clinton, actually, which isn't so far from where you are.
This is true.
You have to drive. You have to drive. So when he left, I realized if I want to keep this house and keep that part of my life, I have to learn to do it. And what was really remarkable is that, you see, when you have to do something, you can. It's that when you don't really have to do it, that all your little phobias and your laziness and your worries take over. But when you actually have to confront something, I think, you know, people can very often rise to a challenge they would prefer not to rise to.
I actually couldn't agree with you more. And I think that if the reward, there's the have to do it, and that seems to be a great motivator. And then I think when the reward is really right on, it pushes you more.
Yes.
You know, like if someone has a plane phobia and they're going to finally fly, but it's to receive the Pulitzer Prize or something, you know, maybe they're going to get themselves on the plane.
Yeah, or if they have a plane phobia, but their child is in an automobile accident and they have to fly to their bedside,
It's incredible what we will do and rise up. You know, you not to sound too ADD here and jump around, but when you mentioned Clinton, here we are. Our studios are in Bridgeport. You know, and in the chapter, I guess it is the first one, I'm looking at, what was my boyfriend thinking, I wonder, when we cruised Route 1, shuttling between our little house and the bookstore, the movie theater, and here you name some landmarks that we know. Al Forno for pizza, the Clam Castle for lobster rolls, visiting Hammonasset Beach to watch the twilight softly over that long expanse of shining sand. Was he daydreaming about the young art critic, thinking about how later he would go off on his bicycle and call the drab colleague from the payphone at the Stop and Shop, blah, blah, blah. Was he thinking about what a drag it was and so on to have a girlfriend who couldn't pass a simple road test? You know, so I love that there were markers about Connecticut that we could relate to.
Well, Connecticut shows up in another story, too, which is a few of them are more, some of them have real plots. But others of them are more ruminations. And this one is called End Of, which is basically about sometimes I feel there's just more and more of everything I hate in life and less of everything I love. And one of the things I love, it begins with a beautiful view from Beach Park Road, which is in Clinton, and it looks out over a beautiful marsh, all these different wonderful subtle shades of green going off to Cedar Island and the sound. And a little housing development for an adult community for people over 55. That's when you grow up, apparently. is being built there, and you know, a big piece of that marsh is ruined. And so I took off from that, and I talked about just how much of how nature is all, you know, people are filling up all the beautiful secret places, and you know, and then I move on to, you know, the usual things we worry about at night after we've finished worrying about other things, global warming and just beautiful old buildings being knocked down. You see that so much on the shoreline, you know, the little sweet cottages get knocked down. Somebody builds some horrible McMansion. So there's a lot of Connecticut in this book.
Yeah, it's one of the things that I really like about it. We're talking with Katha Pollitt, whose book Learning to Drive and Other Life Stories has just been issued in paperback. And when we begin our fundraising at 11 or so, we will be giving away copies of her book for a pledge to WPKN, details to follow. You know, speaking of that chapter, End Of, you know, it's been said that male writers, particularly novelists, allow themselves to ramble, to get tangential, to kind of take up space. They seem to get away with more of that. And one of the things I love about your essays is how you do allow yourself to free associate in a far-ranging way, often with extremely comic effect. But it's not like you're taking me on like an unwanted history of the planets or side trips through mythology.
Uh-huh.
It all makes sense and it all connects and it doesn't feel
indulgent. You know, that is the fun of writing. The fun of writing, well, there are lots of different kinds of pleasures in writing, but one pleasure that I wanted to explore in this book is letting my mind get out of its 1,000 words every 2 weeks box and just sort of see where my thoughts would take me. So I'm glad that you responded to that aspect of the book.
Yeah, and that worked for me. But I want to go back to the question I didn't even let you answer. Was it your decision to title the book this way?
Yeah, I think it was always just going to be called that, both because that is the first essay and because it sets the tone for the whole book. I mean, the idea of
learning to drive as a metaphor?
Learning to drive the metaphor. But also, you know, I don't feel like I'm really great at titles, and I think that was probably just the best one I could think of.
Oh, I think it's great, actually. I mean, I think it's very, it catches people.
Uh-huh.
You know, and as you said, it immediately brings you into the very personal realm, which like you said before, I think is when you go the deepest is when it can be the most transformational. I mean, if we take a somewhat lighter in tone book, Nora Ephron's I Feel Bad About My Neck, people really related to it because she was so open, you know, about these feelings and about the contents of her purse and stuff like that.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
You know, but it wasn't just, I feel like your book had a very wide-ranging impact on me in terms of how you went into the personal. You know, when I first read Web Stalker in The New Yorker, I thought you had reached into my subconscious, you know, to an unhappy period in my life, in my 20s, with a very seductive charmer. And it was such a relief to read your words. And
that essay was even more scandalous than, you know, quote unquote.
Yeah, tell us about that.
Than the other one. You know, in that essay, after the philanderer leaves, I become very fascinated, not to say obsessed, with sort of finding out, well, what was going on all that time? Who is this person? You know, and so I Googled him a lot and found, you know, you can find out a lot on the internet. And so, but it's about sort of like that belated, too late search for facts. And the way the internet kind of draws one in, and you think, oh yeah, it's out there, you know, just like in the X-Files, the truth is out there. And but it's also sort of, the piece is also sort of a meditation about the internet, which is something that fascinates me a lot. But anyway, some people were horrified.
No kidding.
And what's real, what I say is, you know, if looking up someone, if I had called that piece instead of Web Stalker, which is a sort of humorous, melodramatic title. If I had called it Googling My Ex-Boyfriend, nobody would have raised an eyebrow because everybody does that. You know, now people Google something. They go out on a date with someone once and they Google them.
Exactly.
To see what they're writing about, that person is writing about them on their blog.
Oh, it's unbelievable.
Yeah, it's very funny.
So that's what they were shocked by, that you were private detective? But you were it was a survival mode. You were in like the jungle of Nam. You were trying to figure out what was going on and who the hell this person was.
And I hope, you know, I wrote about it in a way that's funny, and it kind of makes fun of myself doing this at the same time as it tries to be true to the actual experience of doing it. But, you know, some people just, they don't go for it. But then a lot of other people did go for it. So go figure, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, I remember about a year ago when I shared with you in an email or something that I could relate to the story. You said that numbers of women were coming up to you or contacting you. Has that been the case, that there are a lot of people who have been through this gaslighting experience?
Oh, yes. Yes. It's really interesting. In fact, I heard from some people who've been through the same experience with this guy. That was really funny. He got around. But
you could develop a whole sisterhood.
It's not just women, too. Men also. Because, you know, we can forget that there are women who behave in a very mystifying, you know, fundamentally dishonest way in their love life. And so I heard from a lot of men who felt, you know, they had these completely bewildering experiences.
We should clarify a little bit, like where the person they're with is lying.
Excuse me?
Where the person they're with is lying, right?
Yeah.
You know, this is the actual specifics. And, you know, maybe has a number of dalliances. Did you begin to get the sense that just something was off and then you followed your hunch?
You mean in my actual
life
relationship?
Yeah.
Well, I think you know what I talk about in the book is if you live with someone who's being deceitful, you can blur that to yourself. You can really, I mean, it sounds so psychobabbly to say so, but you can be in a state of denial, and you just sort of notice less and less, and you just sort of you come up with alternate explanations, and then you just sort of forget about it. And how my, you know, my driving instructor, who's sort of the hero of this story, is always saying, he says, observation, Kata, observation. And that's sort of a metaphor for what I wasn't really doing. And then I say, I noticed that our apartment was becoming a grunge palace, with books and papers collecting dust on every surface and kitty litter crunching underfoot. I observed, very good, Kata, that I was spending many hours in my study engaged in arcane email debates with strangers, that I had gained 25 pounds in our 7 years together and could not fit into many of my clothes. I realized it was not likely that the unfamiliar pink and black striped bikini panties in the clean clothes basket were the result, as he claimed, of a simple laundry room mix-up. But all this awareness was like the impending danger in one of those slow-motion dreams of paralysis, information that could not be processed. It was like seeing the man with the suitcase step off the curb and driving forward anyway.
Wow. Yeah, the phenomenology of denial.
Yeah. And that comes up in other stories, too, because, you know, my mother was a big drinker. And that was another thing that, you know, in our family, I think nobody really realized, because she was very secret. And sometimes I think, you know, well, maybe that experience of sort of not processing information, not going through just the most likely explanation, maybe that sort of set me up to be fooled in this other kind of relationship. I don't know. But these are certainly common phenomena.
That's really interesting.
Not like I'm the only one.
Yeah, for sure. And denial, of course, is like a very early defense, according to Freud, like one of the primitive ones that we all employ when we have to. And then it leads to these higher level defenses, so to speak, like rationalization and intellectualization.
Right. And I think also, I think if you live in a state of untruth with someone, I think another thing that happens is you get depressed.
Mm.
And you just sort of start withdrawing and blaming yourself and all like that. So that, you know, there a lot of things happen to you that you don't really realize are happening because they happen. It happens over time. Living with someone, I think Nora Ephron said this in Heartburn, you know, that you live with someone and you really don't notice as much about them as you would notice if you didn't live with them. That's a sort of an odd thing, you know.
So interesting.
Because you see them every day. It's like you don't notice how someone looking older day by day, but if you don't see them for a year, then you notice.
God, that's so true. I remember once saying to a fellow dog lover in the dog park, like, you know, oh, I just don't even want to think about my dog's aging. You know, like,
yeah.
I'm so attached to them. And he said a very wise thing. He said, it happens very slowly.
Yeah, it's right. It happens very slowly.
You know, you don't notice that first gray eyelash, you know, like it just sort of starts. So it's been a while since these experiences happened to you. Do you feel like remarkably changed? Was the book very cathartic to write? Where are you now? What, if you could say?
Well, if I had told my earlier self, you know, in 5 or 6 years, you won't care, or even sooner.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't have believed it, but it's true. In fact, I almost immediately met the man I'm now married to.
Mm-hmm.
So there was, you know, a happy end in the romance department. I did feel I want to understand this so it won't happen again. And I found a wonderful therapist. I mean, this sounds like such a story of Oprah-like empowerment. But I think I really did sort of make progress in, you know, examining sort of, well, how did that all happen? You know, what is it when you fall for somebody in that way of just like almost love at first sight? You know, what's going on there?
Like what's being enacted? Like what's...
Excuse me?
What's being enacted?
Yeah.
Sort of?
So I feel, you know, my life is, and then writing is also a great pleasure. So I feel my life is, except that I'm, you know, older and closer to death and all like that, but not so close, let's hope. Except for that, things are so much better in every way. So I would say to, you know, people out there who are struggling and are in an unhappy phase of their life, you know, things can change. And you can sometimes make them change.
And the great quote by some, I think, Heraclitus, the only thing permanent in life is change.
Right. What does not change is the will to change, as Charles Olson, the great poet, said.
Ooh, let's exchange quotes obsessively.
Okay, so we did that.
Okay, fine. Okay. So we're done with that. So we're talking with Katha Pollitt, who, of course, is a phenomenal writer and political theorist, also a poet. And this collection, Learning to Drive and Other Life Stories, is newly out in paperback. What are you working on right now?
I'm working on, besides talking to you on the phone, and can I just say one more thing?
Oh, absolutely, anything you like.
Okay, I just want to say that it does occur to me that this book would be a good choice for a book club. It now has, in paperback, a very cheerful cover, which emphasizes its variety, its humor, its, you know, female friendliness. And because it's about a lot of different things, like there's a piece about you know, being the mother of a little baby, which looks back to, you know, a couple of decades, but I'm told nothing has changed in terms of, you know, how marginalized and lonely you can feel at the same time you're having this wonderful experience, all these complicated feelings that you have. And and then there's one about how I proofread pornography.
That's
as a young woman. And there's the Martha Study Group one. So I think, you know, there's a lot to talk about and a lot to disagree about. And it's also, and being in a book club, I know that sometimes this is a factor. It's also not too long. We read some very long books in our book club last year, and that can be a struggle sometime. But anyway, you asked me what else I'm working on. I have a book of poetry coming out in June, also from Random House. It's called The Mind-Body Problem, which is, again, the title of one of the poems. And this is my first book of poems in a really long time. So I'm really excited.
Katha Pollitt, author of Learning to Drive and Other Life Stories, buy her book. And thanks so much for being on the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Vinny.
Okay, take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.